I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is poet Philip Levine. Levine served as U.S. Poet Laureate from 2011 to 2012, and he appeared at the JCCSF in 2012. Resolved to find a voice for the voiceless while working in the auto plants during the 1950s, Levine's work was remarkable for its urban perspective and depictions of the grim reality of blue-collar work and workers. Levine died in 2015 at the age of 87. And now, join Barbara Lane on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Philip Levine.
Philip Levine's poetry is informed by his personal experience working in factories in his hometown of Detroit. It focuses on the moments and textures of the day-to-day life of the working class. Philip Levine taught literature and creative writing at California State University at Fresno for over 30 years. News of the World is the most recent of Phil Levine's 20 books of poems. His many honors include the Pulitzer Prize, two National Book Awards, and two National Book Critics Circle Awards. In his role as Poet Laureate, Philip Levine has said he has one main goal, quote, "I want to bring poetry to people who have no idea how relevant poetry is to their lives." Ladies and gentlemen, the U.S. Poet Laureate, Philip Levine.
Thank you. Thanks for the introduction. Thanks for asking me to come here. Thanks for turning the heat up. I'm actually too hot. And I'm going to ask you to take my jacket, but don't take the boarding passes, please. Thank you. No, you don't have to iron it or anything. It's in good shape. All right, what am I going to read? You know, I have poems that go in so many different directions. I want to read one from my second book. I rarely read these old poems. It's not that I don't like them. It's that they're so much better than what I write now. I was young and earnest and energetic and just and I was imaginative, and now I'm Phil. It's called Baby Vion, and it's about a tiny little man who's related to me and who I thought had died and then finally found. He's a prize fighter. And because of his appearance, he is the villain wherever he goes. Baby Vion. He tells me in Bangkok he's robbed because he's white. In London, because he's black. In Barcelona, Jew. In Paris, Arab. Everywhere and at all times. And he fights back. He holds up seven thick little fingers to show me he's rated seventh in the world. And there's no passion in his voice, no anger in the flat brown eyes flecked with blood. He asks me to tell all I can remember of my father, his uncle. He talks of the war in North Africa and what came after, the loss of his father, the loss of his brother, the windows of the bakery smashed and the fresh bread dusted with glass, the warm smell of rye so strong. He ate till his mouth filled with blood. Here they live. Here they live and not die. And he points down at his black head ridged with the black kinks of hair. He touches my hair. Tells me I should never disparage the stiff bristles that guard the head of the fighter. Sadly, his fingers wander over my face. And he says, how fair I am, how smooth. We stand to end this first and last visit. Stiff, 116 pounds, 5'2", no bigger than a girl. He holds my shoulders, kisses my lips, his eyes still open. My imaginary brother, my cousin, myself made otherwise by all his pain. Ah, yes. Well, let me find something depressing. You know, when I lived in Detroit, we always used to go to Chicago. We went to Chicago a lot when I was like a teenager, even younger. No, not younger. I didn't drive to Detroit to Chicago at age 9 or take the bus. And, you know, Chicago wasn't the treat it was supposed to be. It was Detroit with a big lake. And so then we started going to New York, which was not Detroit with anything. It was it was itself. But this is a poem about driving, or its origin is in driving to Chicago for one reason or another. It's called The Helmet, and it comes out of the aftermath of the Korean War. I had occasion to go to a number of army depots because I was working for a guy who was buying parts, automobile and aviation parts. And so I'd go to these depots and see hillsides of tanks and artillery, and then go into these places where there were tons of war equipment called the helmet. All the way on the road to Gary, he could see where the sky shone just out of reach and smell the rich smell of work as strong as money. But when he got there, the night was over. People were going to work and back. The sidewalks were lakes no one walked on. The diners were saying, time to eat. So he stopped and talked to a woman who'd been up late making helmets. There are white hands the color of steel. They have put their lives into steel. And if hands could lay down their lives, these hands would be helmets. He and the woman did not lie down, not because she would praise the steel helmet boarding a train for no war, not because he would find the unjeweled crown in a surplus store where hands were sold. They did not lie down face to face because of the waste of being so close. And they were too tired of being each other to try to be lovers, and because they had to sit up straight so they could eat. Nothing but cheerfulness falling from the sky. All right, before I read something cheerful, let me read. The war of my boyhood was the Spanish Civil War. I remember reading a review of a book called The Names of the Lost, which has on the cover a photograph by, Robert Capa, of the remnants of the Loyalist Army crossing into France. I put that on the cover. And it got reviewed in a New York paper, the book, by a woman who was puzzled by two facts. One, that I was an autobiographical poet. And the second was that I had fought in Spain, since the war ended there when I was 9. She mused over this, but was incapable of arriving at the fact that I imagined it. And yet it was a positive review. Can you imagine what it would have said were it a negative review? She gave up that job and became the Secretary of State. They moved her up, you know. This is called To P.L., 1916 to 1937, A Soldier of the Republic, an American. Gray earth peeping through snow. You lay for 3 days with one side of your face frozen to the ground. They tied your cheek with the red and black scarf of the anarchists and bundled you in canvas and threw you away. Before that, an old countrywoman of the Aragon, spitting on her thumb, rubbing it against her forefinger, stole your black Wellingtons, the gray hunting socks, and the long, slender knife you wore in a little leather scabbard riding your right hip. She honed it, ran her finger down the blade and laughed, though she had no meat to cut, blessing your tight fists that had fallen side by side like frozen faces on your hard belly that was becoming earth. Years later, she saw the two faces at table and turned from the bread and the steaming oily soup, turned to the darkness of the open door, and opened her eyes to darkness, that they might be filled with anything but these two faces squeezed in the blue of snow and snow and snow. She blessed your feet, still pink, with hard yellow shields of skin at heel and toe. And she laughed, scampering across the road into the goat field and up the long hill, the boots bundled in her skirts, and the gray hunting socks, and the knife. For 7 weeks, she wore the boots, stuffed with rags at toe and heel. She thought she understood why you lay down to rest, even in snow, and gave them to a nephew, and the gray socks, too. The knife is still used, the black handle almost white, the blade worn thin since there is meat to cut. Without laughter, she is gone 10 years now. And on the road to Huesca in spring, there is no one to look for you among the wild jonquils, the curling grasses at the roadside, and the blood-red poppies. No one to look on the farthest tip of wind breathing down from the mountains and shaking the stunted pines you hid among. I wanted to read another poem that derives from that era and that war. It's in here, honest. Once at a reading, I kept looking for a poem. And, you know, I mean, 10 minutes went by. And you know, the audience was getting restive or beginning to wake up, thinking it was over. And I realized I'd never written the poem. It was an idea I'd had, and I tried to write it over and over. And I finally wanted to quit. And so I sort of told myself, well, it's done. And I assumed that I had done it. Yeah, this is called To Cipriano in the Wind. And Cipriano is a survivor of the Spanish Civil War. And the poem takes place in Detroit. When he speaks of the scars across his shoulders, he was tortured. He was an anarchist. He was captured and tortured, and he escaped. And he got away, and before World War II started, he got to the States, and I meet him. To Cipriano in the Wind. Where did your words go? Cipriano, spoken to me 38 years ago in the back of Peerless Cleaners. Where raised on a little wooden platform, you bowed to the hissing press. And under the glaring bulb, the scars across your shoulders, a gift of my country, gleamed like old wood. Dignidad, you said into my boy's wide eyes, without is no riches. And Ferenti, the dapper Sicilian coat maker, laughed. What could a pants presser know of dignity? That was the winter of 41. It would take my brother off to war where you had come from. It would bring great snowfalls graying in the streets and the news of death racing through the halls of my school. I was growing. Soon I would be your height. And you tell me eye to eye, someday the world is ours. Someday you will see. And your eyes burned in your fine white face until I thought you would burn. That was the winter of 41. Bataan would fall to the Japanese and Sam Bogosian would make the long march with bayonet wounds in both legs. And somehow, in spite of burning acid splashed across his chest and the acids of his own anger rising toward his heart, he would return to us and eat the stale bread of victory. Cipriano, do you remember what followed the worst snow? It rained all night, and in the dawn the streets gleamed, and within a week wild flocks leaped in the open fields. I told you our word for it, spring. And you said, spring, spring, it always come after. Soon the Germans rolled east into Russia, and my cousins died. I walked alone in the warm spring winds of evening and said, dignity. I said your words, Cipriano, into the winds. I said, someday this will all be ours. Come back, Cipriano Mera. Step out of the wind and dressed in the robe of your pain, tell me again that this world will be ours. Enter my dreams or my life, Cipriano. Come back out of the wind. Thank you. Well, he was a teacher to me. One of the most important teachers I think I ever had, especially as a young guy. A patient man. Unpretentious. His English, of course, as I quoted him, you could hear, wasn't very good. And Whitman advised, you know, the American poets to go among powerful, uneducated people. I did my best to do that. I took a job at a state college. Yeah, I used to get a lot of players in the football team because they heard I liked sports, and I'd flunk them. One of my other great teachers, equal to Cipriano and his brothers in arms, was John Keats, who I encountered only, of course, in books. And what influenced me the most were the letters, which I think is probably the most important book I ever read for me. There's so much wisdom and brilliance. And the letter that moves me the most was the one to his brother George, who was written when he was 24. Of course, he never lived beyond 25. And I quote one of the letters, that one that he wrote to George, in this poem. So it's, having been asked, what is a man? It grew out of a visit I made to a public school, it was a university, the University of Alabama in Birmingham. And a teacher there had her students write me before I got there. and asked me questions. And, you know, not all of them did, but a few did. And one young woman wrote, and her question was very simple. What is a man? And I was sort of stunned by this young woman's belief that a poet could tell her. That I don't know, I must have been about 50 at the time, 50 somewhere in there. And I thought, my God, she reads a couple of my poems and she thinks I know what everything is. So I didn't answer her, nor did I go there with an answer. Instead, I wrote this poem and read it to her class when I wound up there.
You're listening to poet Philip Levine, who served as U.S. Poet Laureate from 2011 to 2012, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Having been asked, what is a man? This takes place in New York. My oldest son comes to visit me in the hospital. He brings giant peonies, and the nurse puts them in a glass vase, and they sag quietly on the windowsill, where they seem afraid to gaze out at the city smoking beneath. He asks when I will be coming home. I don't know. He says there are wires running from me to a television set on which my heartbeat is a Sunday spectacular. How do I look? I say. He studies the screen and says, I don't know. Takes a specialist to tell you how you look in this place. And none will. I must have slept. And when I waken, I'm alone and the old man next to me is gone. And the room is going dark. This is the Sunday that will fill the unspoken promise of all those vanished Sundays when a shadow on the edge of sight grew near, enormous, hesitated, and left. And I sighed with weariness, knowing one more week was here to live. At last, a time and place to die are given me, and even a small reason. The flowers have turned now that the windows have gone dark, and I see their pale faces in the soft mirror of the glass. No, they aren't crying, for this is not the veil of tears. They are quietly laughing as flowers always do in the company of men, because this is the place where souls are made. Their laughter whispers. I will read Keats again. I will rise and go into the world unwired and free, because I am no longer a movie. I have no beginning, no middle, no end. No film score underscoring each act. No costume department. No expert on color. I am merely a man, dressing in the dark, because that is what a man is. So many mouthfuls of laughter and so many more. All there can be behind the sad brown backs of peonies. What I quoted from Keats is because this is the place where souls are made. And also there's a reference there in that letter to the veil of tears, which John Keats said the world is not. It's an amazing letter. If you have time, go find it. You will be, I hope, as moved and as enlightened as I was. Let me read something nutty. This is called The Language Problem. It takes its title, really, from a poem I read probably when I was 18 years old, and this I wrote 2 years ago, I think, by William Empson. which has a refrain line in it. The language problem, but you've got to try. His poem is about waking in bed in Tokyo with a Japanese woman, his lady friend, because an earthquake has awakened them. My poem is not about anything quite so dramatic. It takes place in Cuba. The language problem. Cuban Spanish is incomprehensible even to Cubans. If you spit in his face, he'll tell you it's raining, the cab driver said. In Cuban, it means your cigar is from Tampa. Single, desperate, almost 40, my ex-wife told the Cuban doctor she would give $1 million for a perfect pair of breasts. God hates a coward, he said, and directed her to an orthopedic shoe store where everything smelled like iodine. A full-page ad on the back of Nueva Prensa Cubana clearly read, quote, free rum, 24 hours a day and more on weekends. Free rum was in italics. When I showed up that evening at the right address, Calle Obispo 28, the little merchant I spoke to said, rum? This is not a distillery. They were flogging Venetian blue umbrellas for $4 American. Mine was made in Taiwan, and when it rained, refused to open. Before sunset, the streets filled with music. In the great plaza of the revolution, the dark came slowly, filled with the perfume of automobile exhaust and wisteria. I danced with a girl from Santiago de Cuba. Gabriela Mistral Garcia was her name. She was taller than I and wore her black hair in a wiry tangle. She was a year from her doctorate in critical theory. After our dance, she grabbed me powerfully by the shoulders as a comandante in a movie might, leaned down as though to kiss me on the cheek and whispered in my good ear, I dream of tenure. It was the 50s all over again. You know, a revolution can only change so much, right? Not academia. I went to Fresno in 1958. And there are two questions that I'm always asked over and over, and I really can't answer them as well as I should. One, because I've had so much practice, so I lie, you know, I invent answers. One is, you know, why did you become a poet? It's hard to answer. It's what I wanted to do. The other is, why did you stay in Fresno? Well, I can't say it's because I wanted to do it, you know? It has its charms. It's just hard to think of what they might be. I mean, if you like crime, for example, and dust and polluted air and water that tastes like sewage, it's your town. Well, the landscape is fantastic, of course. You know, when we first moved there, I went there with my wife and children. You could see the mountains every day. I'm embarrassed to say how long ago that was, but many of you weren't born. Maybe none of you were born. This is called Our Valley, and Fresno sits between these two mountain ranges. Well, the Sierra Nevada is a real mountains. And then the coastal thing is, you know, really just exaggerated hills. But they're both beautiful, of course. And we are cut off, of course, from the ocean and the weather that is at the ocean. It's hot in Fresno in the summer. It's sort of foggy and crappy in the winter. It's very nice right now. Spring. Spring, spring. It always come after. Our valley. It's the San Joaquin Valley, the Great Valley, Central Valley of California. We don't see the ocean. Not ever. But in July and August, when the worst heat seems to rise from the hard clay of this valley, you could be walking through a fig orchard when suddenly the wind cools, and for a moment you get a whiff of salt, and in that moment you can almost believe something is waiting beyond the Pacheco Pass, something massive, irrational. And so powerful, even the mountains that rise east of here have no word for it. You probably think I'm nuts saying the mountains have no word for ocean. But if you live here, you begin to believe they know everything. They maintain that huge silence we think of as divine. A silence that grows in autumn when snow falls slowly between the pines, and the wind dies to less than a whisper, and you can barely catch your breath because you're thrilled and terrified. You have to remember, this isn't your land. It belongs to no one, like the sea you once lived beside and thought was yours. Remember the small boats that bobbed out as the waves rode in? And the men who carved a living from it only to find themselves carved down to nothing. Now you say, this is home. So go ahead, worship the mountains as they dissolve in dust. Wait on the wind. Catch a scent of salt. Call it our life. I had a friend who was about to title a book on love, book of poems on love. And I told him I thought that was not a good title. You know, it's, you know, first thing, he's a wonderful man, but he's a clumsy man. And in what he says, and I said, you don't want to pass yourself off as someone who knows what there is to know about love. Nobody knows anything about love. And I said, I have a title for you. It's so much better. And you have some witty poems in there. So I think you should call it Of Love and Other Disasters. And he rejected the title. He told me his wife didn't like it. So I thought I'd use it. And I did. I mean, I started to write a poem about love, and I said, oh, damn it, this is perfect. Because it's about a disaster waiting to happen. Of love, and this takes place in Detroit, which was a city once on the Detroit River in eastern Michigan. I don't know. Well, it is there. If you want to see what it looks like now, let me recommend a book. It's called Detroit Disassembled, and it's a book of photographs by a man named Andrew Moore, and it's a remarkable book, remarkable. And you can find it on a TV thing, PBS thing, with me talking about it, about the photographs. The Poetry Foundation has it. You ever look at the Poetry Foundation? They have a huge website. That's the outfit that publishes Poetry Magazine, and to which a woman named, what the hell was her name? Lily. Ruth Lily. She inherited all that drug money. Not from Mexico. I mean American drug money. And she gave $100 million to Poetry Magazine, and they started this foundation. And now they have this website. You can get all kinds of people reading, people talking, people lying. It's quite wonderful. And you can get the entire history of Poetry Magazine. Found it. It'll be 100 years old this year. The oldest poetry magazine in the world, they claim. But there are some in Serbo-Croatian that were created in 1107. and, you know, the whole thing, founded by Harriet Monroe, yes, of Love and Other Disasters. The punch press operator from up north met the assembler from West Virginia in a bar near the stadium. Friday, late, but too early to go home alone. Neither had anything in mind, so they conversed about the upcoming baseball season, about which neither cared. We could be a couple, he thought. But she was all wrong, way too skinny. For years, he'd had an image of the way a woman should look, and it wasn't her. It wasn't anyone he'd ever known, certainly not his ex-wife, who'd moved back north to live with her high school sweetheart, about killed him. I don't need that, he almost said aloud, and then realized she'd been talking to someone, maybe to him, about how she couldn't get her hands right, how the grease ate so deeply into her skin, it became a part of her. And she put her hand palm up on the bar and pointed with her cigarette at the deep lines the work had carved. The lifeline, he said. Which one is that? None, she said. And he noticed that her eyes were hazel, flecked with tiny spots of gold, and then embarrassed, looked back at her hand, which seemed tiny and delicate. The fingers yellowed with calluses, but slender and fine. She took a paper napkin off the bar, spit on it, and told him to hold still while she carefully lifted his glasses, leaving him half blind, and wiped something off just above his left cheekbone. There, she said, handing him back his glasses. I got it. And even with his glasses on, what she showed him was nothing he could see. Maybe only make-believe. He thought, better get out of here before it's too late. But suspected too late was what he wanted. Thank you. You know, this is a poem about World War II. Well, it's really not about the war. It's about people who were in the war. And I try to catch the atmosphere of fear and sadness that someone my age felt, and that, you know, older people felt. Those, you know, I had relatives who were in the war. My brother, for example, my older brother, during the war. When my brother came home from war, he carried his left arm in a black sling, but assures us most of it was still there. Spring was late. The trees forgot to leaf out. I stood in a long line waiting for bread. The woman behind me said it was shameless. Someone as strong as I, still home, still intact, while her Michael was burning to death. Yes, she could feel the fire, could smell his pain all the way from Tarawa, or was it Midway? And he's so young, younger than I, who was only 14, taller, more handsome in his white uniform, turning slowly gray, the way unprimed wood grays slowly in the grate when the flames sputter and die. I think I'm going mad, she said. And when I turned to face her, she placed both hands on my shoulders, kissed each eyelid, hugged me to her breasts, and whispered wetly in my bad ear words I'd never heard before. When I got home, my brother ate the bread carefully, one slice at a time until nothing was left but a blank plate. Did you see her? He asked. The woman in hell, Michael's wife. That afternoon, I walked the crowded streets looking for something I couldn't name. Something familiar. A face or a voice or less. But not these shards of ash that fell from heaven.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is poet Philip Levine. Levine served as U.S. Poet Laureate from 2011 to 2012, and he appeared at the JCCSF in 2012. Levine died in 2015 at the age of 87. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at KALW.org.
And I'll read one more poem, and I thank you for being such a nice audience. I can hear your concentration. You know, it's the silence that makes all the difference. This poem is called My Father Was Cigarette, 12 years before the Nazis could break his heart. My father died in 1933, and had he lived, he would have known what happened to his family still in Western Russia. The poem was inspired also by a painting I saw, a primitive painting by a painter named Harry Lieberman. I saw it in New York City in their wonderful Museum of Folk Art. My father was cigarette 12 years before the Nazis could break his heart. I remember the room in which he held a kitchen match and with his thumbnail commanded it to flame. A brown sofa, two easy chairs, one covered with flowers, a black piano no one ever played, half covered by a long fringed ornamental scarf Ray Estrada brought back from Mexico in 1931. How new the world is, you say. In that room, someone is speaking about money, asking why it matters, and my father exhales the blue smoke and says, $1 million, even in large bills, would be impossible. He's telling me, because I see now I'm the one who asked, for I dream of money, always coins and bills that run through my hands, money I find in the corners of unknown rooms or in metal boxes I dig up in the backyard flower beds of houses I've never seen. My father rises now and goes to the closet. It's as though someone were directing a play and my father's part called for him to stand so that the audience, which must be you, could see him in white shirt, dark trousers held up by suspenders, a sign of the times, and conclude he is taller than his son will ever be. And as he dips into his jacket, you'll know his role calls for him to exit by the front door, leaving something unfinished. The closet light still on, the cigarette still burning dangerously, a Yiddish paper folded to the right place so that a photograph of Hindenburg in full military regalia swims up to you out of all the details we lived. I remember the way the match flared, blue and yellow in the deepening light of a cool afternoon in early September. And the sound, part iron, part animal, part music, as the air rushed toward it out of my mouth, and his intake of breath through the lucky strike, and the smoke hanging on after the door closed and the play ran out of acts and actors and the audience, which must be you, grew tired of these lives that finally come to nothing or no more than the furniture and the cotton drapes left open so the darkening sky can seem to have the last word with half a moon and a showering of fake stars to say what the stars always say about the ordinary. Oh, you're still here. 60 years later, you wonder what became of us. Why someone put it in a book and left the book open to a page no one reads. Everything tells you he never came back, though he did before he didn't. Everything suggests this was the year Hitler came to power, the year my grandmother learned to read English novels and fell in love with David Copperfield and Oliver Twist, which she read to me seated on a stool beside my bed until I fell asleep. Everything tells you this is a preface to something important, the Second World War, the news that leaked back from Poland that the villages were gone. The truth is, if there is a truth, I remember the room. I remember the flame, the blue smoke, how bright and slippery were the secret coins, how David Copperfield doubted his own name, how sweet the stars seemed, peeping and blinking, how close the moon, how utterly silent the piano. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you, Philip Levine. Questions?
Thank you so much. How were you notified that you had been chosen to be the poet laureate, please?
Well, it was an unusually nice morning, and there was a little bird at my window. It was a mockingbird. And it was sent by the library to mock me. No, the phone rang, and a man said, no, wait a minute. No, I came home. I'd been away, and the answering machine said, this is Jim Billington at the Library of Congress. I'd like you to call me back. And gave me his number. And my wife, Franny, said, what's that all about? And I said, oh, you know, before they pick poet laureate, they consult with a lot of people, poets, what have you. And she said, who are you going to tell them? And I don't know. I'll think of somebody. I think Yusuf Komunyakaa. I think he's a fabulous poet. And so I called him back. And then he said, we've chosen you. And I thought, you're crazy. because I'm not that reliable. I'm liable to say anything, anywhere. And I have embarrassed the library, if a library can be embarrassed. But I was happy to get it. I mean, it's been fun.
The IRO workshop in the 1950s cast an enormous shadow for the quality of work produced by its faculty and its students. Could you share something of what it was like to be there then?
Yeah, it was... well, in poetry, when I went there in 1950-whatever, 54, I think, 5, something like that, the first person I studied with was Robert Lowell. And he was a young man then. You know, he wasn't 40 yet. And I went there to study with him. And he was a terrible teacher. he was a Lowell. And we were a bunch of, you know, Midwestern hicks or whatever the hell he thought. But there were some terrific people in the class. That class had three students who would go on to get the Pulitzer Prize. Me and Don Justice and W.D. Snodgrass. And there were some other poets. There was one who came and settled here, Bill Dickey, William Dickey. He was in that class. He went on to win the Yale thing and published a lot of wonderful books. And then the second semester was John Berryman. And he was the best teacher I ever had.
You're known mostly for your admiration and compassion and description of the working men and women of America, particularly in manufacturing. The contrast today is that those same workers push buttons in factories, and we've exported the old, heavier manufacturing. What would be your image of the working man and woman? How would you find the compassion for them today that you've evoked in the past?
I don't think finding sympathy, compassion for people who have a tough life is very difficult. I mean, it's just second nature, isn't it? I mean, you see people who have these no-end jobs and they eke out a living, and you know from your school days that the same people, for example, that I worked with or I went to school with, you know, we've talked when we were kids and they had the same hope for their lives and visions for their life. They didn't want to be poets, but they wanted to be something significant. And I remember once I went back to Detroit to see my brother and one of my brothers who still lived there. I was sitting on his porch and evening was coming. It's in the spring. I was drinking a beer and a man walked down the street. And I looked at him and I said, "That's Jimmy Wilson. That's Jimmy Wilson." He was in my freshman class at Wayne University. And he was this very powerful. At that time, he had just finished his high school career. He was a terrific athlete, a terrific sprinter, long jumper, and a terrific football player. And now he was this sort of burly guy with a lunchbox. And he looked at me, and I said, "Jimmy?" And he said, "Yeah." And I went down, and we talked for a while. And he said, "What are you doing? You still, you know, at that poetry?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm still with the poetry." And great. And I didn't have to ask him what he was doing. You ask a question like that because you know that half of America practically has no compassion for people who work hard. You know, I don't know. They have these debates with these crazy monkeys on who, you know. So you live in a country with so many morons and such a dearth of kindness and charity, faith, hope, and charity, you know, the great virtues, and charity being the chiefest of them all. And we are a country, you know, with a policy of if you don't have a job, you don't deserve it, you know. We'll measure your virtue with your bank account. So, you know, they're our neighbors. I hope they awaken.
Teach us about editing. You clearly take it down to the finest of the bones and the sinews. And if you can tell us anything about what you say to yourself to make it work, please.
It's true, I do talk to myself. My wife has noticed for now 30 years and tells me, "Are you talking to me?" You know, she sounds like taxi driver, right? "You're talking to me?" I didn't know, honey. I had a wonderful student. He and I became very good friends. And unfortunately, he died young. His name was Ernesto Trejo. We did a book together, Tarumba, The Selected Poems of Jaime Sabines. It's in print now. It's a wonderful book. We did it together. He was from Mexico. And one night, Near the end of my teaching, he was dying of cancer, and he came to my class regularly because he wanted something to distract him. And I was teaching with another man, a Spaniard, a Basque actually, a course in translation of modern poetry in Spanish. And I had translated a poem of Antonio Machado into rhymed pentameter. But no, it wasn't pentameter. It was this rhymed 10-syllable line. But the rhymes were very subtle. I tried to keep them subtle. And very much like the original by Machado. And he said to me in class, "Phil, how do you do this?" And I said, "What do you mean, how do you do it? You translated all those Sabine's poems with me. Yeah, but we didn't use rhyme. How come you used rhyme?" I said, "I just wanted to do it again. I used to write in rhyme." "How do you do that sort of thing?" And I said, "You just work at it. You know, you work. You work at it. You do it for years and then it's second nature." "Okay." So I drove him home. He didn't have a parking sticker and he wasn't in great health. So I picked him up and after class I drove him home. And I stopped in front of his house. And now there's just the two of us. And he said to me, "Phil, now no one else is listening. Tell me how you do it." And he really thought there was some kind of a gimmick, a trick. And it's the same with your question. There is no answer. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. The greatest virtue you can have if you want to be a writer is patience. Stick with it. Because, don't hurry. That's why, and it was a hard lesson for me to learn. I wanted to write the American War and Peace, and I wanted to do it in a week. I had read War and Peace, and I said, I know enough to write, which was, of course, I didn't know anywhere near enough. And I sat there writing and writing and writing and got more and more tired. And I did myself a favor. I stopped. And I never looked back at it. I just said, "Goodbye." That's the other virtue you need, to throw it away, to admit it's crap. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was poet Philip Levine. Levine served as U.S. Poet Laureate from 2011 to 2012, and he appeared at the JCCSF in 2012. Levine died in 2015 at the age of 87. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.